KBSI in the world. I'm John Batchelor. Nayib Bukele, the president of a very small state, but a critical state for its success against the gangs. This is El Salvador. San Salvador election momentarily will produce what I'm told is a landslide for Bukele, a maverick president. He's young. He appears in public with his baseball cap turned around. He bought an enormous amount of Bitcoin before the crash. He has plans to use a volcano, an active volcano, to power the mining of Bitcoin. I don't know where that project is, but it's quite fantastic. It reminds me of how Graham Greene could enjoy this as a novel. In addition to the fact, he seems to have detained at some point tens of thousands, the number is very high, of young people, some associated with the cartel, some just on the wrong side of the street when the police came through. They're being held against their wishes. I don't know their status, but there have been photographs of brutality or what appears to be dehumanization in the prisons. However, the crime rate has dropped. The murder rate has dropped. The landslide effect is very much representation of law and order in the streets of San Salvador. And there's even talk that other presidents in Central America, bothered by these same powerful cartels, are following the model. I believe Costa Rica is mentioned in that. Professor, what do we make of Bukele? What does Washington make of Bukele? Thank you.
Well, John, as you pointed out, from the perspective of Salvadorians, going back to the legacy of violence which existed during the Civil War, which existed after the Civil War, during the years when I engaged regularly in El Salvador, there was a point at which there were 104 murders per 100,000 people. You couldn't go out in the street. Businesses were crippled under fears of extortion. People that lived, the 2 million Salvadorians that lived in the United States, they had to worry about whether their aunts and grandmothers were basically being extorted by the gangs or whether something could happen to them when they went down to the market. It was a really oppressive way to live, but it was part of the Salvadoran reality that it was almost impossible to think how things could change. And so really the impact of Bukele, in addition to his style with his jeans and sweaters and selfies and social media campaign calling himself the region's coolest dictator, but really getting the murder rate down from 104 to literally just over 2 per 100,000. I mean, it's right now lower than any part in the region, even the United States, except Canada. That has been a revelation. And it's something I think that Salvadorians, having lived under that previous period, just are so ecstatic about the change that they don't seem to be putting much weight on the fact that you have maybe 10% of those 70,000 plus people who have been rounded up on suspicion of gang membership, that about 10% of them are innocent, unless it's your son, or unless it's your friend who's one of the people who are rounded up. But having said that, also given Bukele's very powerful way of investing in social media, sophisticated videos of connecting with the people, it's really about that kind of security and connection that has literally 82% of Salvadorans supporting Bukele. And so the question really is not whether Bukele is elected or not, but it is whether his New Ideas Party ends up completely dominating the legislature, or whether it stays with its existing two-thirds. There's actually going to be also an election for mayors and local, which is going to occur just a couple weeks after. And that will be another important election that some of the other parties might have a chance of winning. But the U.S. perspective, I think, is looking at the situation with some concern, because he's Bukele, despite his success, has clearly been trampling on the rights of Salvadorians and free speech rights and press rights, and journals such as is El Faro, famous for going after leaders and calling out bad behavior, have been have sensed that they are attacked on social media and intimidated in other means. And so I think there's a certain amount of concern, while at the same time the U.S. administration, the Biden administration, doesn't want to completely take away from the successes that Bukele has achieved and certainly the importance of El Salvador as a partner. But I think a bit of nervousness as one looks towards that success and yet looking for ways to continue to engage with Bukele after he wins this Sunday's election.
There's a drought in Central America. It mostly is concerned in Panama, where there's insufficient water for the regular traffic to pass through from Atlantic to Pacific, but the drought extends to Salvador and other parts of Latin America. Professor, Panama, is it in a crisis or is it managing this severe reduction of revenue?
Well, Panama is in multiple different crises, although as a relatively well-governed and relatively prosperous state, it has a little bit more legroom to weather that crisis. But certainly the cutting roughly in half of revenues going through the Panama Canal because the drought, the lowering of water levels in Lake Gaitun forced the reduction by about half of the number of transits in the draft of ships that were allowed to go through. At the same time, Panama has had other problems, especially a series of legal cases and administrative actions that has led to the shutdown of First Quantum, a massive Canadian mining firm that was employing directly and indirectly about 40,000 Panamanians, responsible for about 5% of the entire Panamanian GDP, because it was ruled that their contract with the government was improper. They had to shut down with no way of turning things around. And so that is another big hit to the Panamanian economy. There is some frustration with longstanding effects of COVID in terms of really kind of exposing some of the difficulties with the slowdown of public works projects and some of Panamanians' frustration with corruption, not just under the current Cortizo administration, but certainly it is highlighted that, especially his Vice President Cortizo. In addition to that, in all of these things, Panamanians remembering with nostalgia the good old days, the pre-COVID days when Ricardo Martinelli was president. And so right now, Martinelli is running about 40% in the polls, appears very likely to be the one who will be selected to be Panama's new president. The fact that Martinelli has been essentially had a legal case, a conviction against him in Panama, as well as was extradited from the United States, and the U.S. actually pursued cases against his sons, means that the likely comeback of Martinelli as Panama's next president will create some possibilities for dramatic changes and certainly some challenges for maintaining the close relationship between the U.S. and in Panama, although Martinelli at least says that he bears no grudges for his extradition and his children being obliged in U.S. courts to testify against him. We'll see about that. But it will be a challenging new chapter on top of Panama's current challenges.
To the Andes, to the troubled Ecuador with the new president, Noboa, sometimes under siege, now announcing a reduction of a subsidy for gasoline. Will this disrupt again, Professor?
Well, it's interesting that in October 2019, the massive protests that almost brought down the Ecuadorian government then were in themselves due to Ecuador in a real financial pinch, tried to reduce in a very modest way the subsidies that it has long put on gasoline. And again, that on top of other things led to targeted protests in Quito and indeed the shutdown of the one of Ecuador's major oil pipelines, the Sote pipeline, that almost brought down the government back then. And so it's symbolic that pro-market young Daniel Noboa has talked about cutting fuel subsidies. And it really reflects that Ecuador continues to have significant debts. It's in a financially difficult situation. So really, right now, Noboa is doing everything that he can to raise money to help finance this very necessary but expensive, all of government offensive against the gangs and the narco groups behind them that have just terrorized the country. And so Noboa, in addition to talking about fuel subsidies, is also talking about an increase in the value-added tax by about 3 percentage points. He's talked about the increasing some other taxes as well. And he's talked about least temporarily postponing the shutdown of the Yasuni oil fields, something that is expected to be a $1.8 billion hit to the Ecuadorian economy, but something that was decided for environmental reasons by a referendum. But so basically, Noboa is scrambling to raise and get money where he can to have the necessary resources for fighting this necessary war against the gangs, in combination, of course, with the United States, remembering, of course, that the head of U.S. Southern Command, General Richardson, and Biden administration special representative Christopher Dodd just visited Ecuador, committing a series of expedited new help, everything from Kevlar vests to ambulances to logistics vehicles to other specialized equipment, and so it's a real scramble for money and to deal with the security situation. But my analysis is that Ecuador will get through this. It is well institutionalized. Its institutions still work. It has a healthy political culture, and so Noboa is struggling through.
Your mention of struggle. We take back to Peru, which went through great turmoil in 22-23, is now apparently stabilizing, except suddenly there's a protest at Machu Picchu. Tourists are cut off. You tell me, though, this is a local protest, or does it speak to the capital?
Well, the key thing here is that there was a, you know, as happens in many places in the Peruvian highlands and in hinterlands, there was a relatively corrupt local community organization that had really kind of captured the tourist concessions for Machu Picchu, which, for those who've heard anything about Peru, the one place that we gringos visit in Peru is Machu Picchu. And so the government, in a very pragmatic way, tried to replace this local mafia with a ticket system that was a little bit more objective. It was a little bit more digital. It was a little bit more fair. But because it threatened the privileges of the local mafia that ran the place, they organized major protests, which forced the government to shut down this big tourist site. And if you want to get the attention of the Western media, have a little protest in the one place that all the gringos think of when they go to Peru on vacation. So it's really jumped in the international media. But there are broader issues. I mean, it goes to the difficulties that the Boluarte government has had and continues to have with the people of the highlands and in the jungle regions. These are the people that Pedro Castillo, Peru's previous president, really appealed to as the heart of his support. And it also goes to some of the endemic issues of corruption and governance in different parts of Peru, as illustrated by this small case with this essentially local tourist concession mafia.
Venezuela, very big trouble when we come back. Professor Avenelis, this is the New World Report. I'm John Bash.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.